This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. Today we welcome pianist Tanya Gabrielian. This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musician Spotlight. My guest today is Tanya Gabrielian. Nice to see you.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for making time to come in and visit with us today. And I'm going to spell your name for listeners because I'm going to refer them to your website, which is TanyaGabrielian.com. TanyaGabrielian.com.
Yes. Silent P in front of Tanya.
No silent P.
I kind of like to put one, but you know, no one's perfect.
That would distinguish you from all the other Tanya.
I'm trying. I mean, the Tanya Harding comparison I got a lot.
Oh, huh.
So I like to say Tanya is with an A is a little less white trashy than Tanya Harding, but I love her. I've always had a soft spot for her, even from the beginning, because you know she'd been through a lot.
Yeah. Oh, that's a fascinating story.
Oh, and yeah.
Yours is pretty good as well.
No movies made yet.
Not yet.
Or ever, probably.
Life is yet to unfold in ways that we don't know. I wanted to also just check in. The most recent recording is the remix, the Bach transcriptions,
yes.
Rather. Okay, so that's just one of several recordings you have under your own name. Also, you have a Facebook page, of course, and all over social media. I wanted to go into your story a little bit here, and I'm going to start. It's always a little embarrassing to read someone's bio to them when they're saying, okay, but bear with me for a second, because then I'm going to go off on another, hopefully more interesting tangent here. Tanya shot onto the international stage at the age of 20 with back-to-back victories at the Aram Khachaturian?
That's close enough.
That's probably butchered it. International Piano Competition and the Scottish International Piano Competition. Performances all over the world. Carnegie Hall, Alice Tully Hall, New York, Sydney Opera House, Queen Elizabeth Hall in London. And how do you pronounce Salle Couteau in Paris? But beyond all that, it kind of starts the story when there's way more to it. I want to go to your earliest musical memory.
I know, being forced to practice by my parents.
anything before that even.
No, I mean,
playing
piano was not a choice to me as a kid. Mm-hmm. I had tiger mom and tiger dad, you know, you practice or they don't love you. So, I have one memory of my first piano teacher. I think Elizabeth Chen or something. I don't remember. I started when I was 3. Apparently, my first word was pop when my sister and my mom were singing, you know, Pop Goes the Weasel song. And I put in the Pop Goes the Weasel at the end. So, you know, I remember doing my first competition when I was 4 years old, UNICEF competition. I mean, I barely knew how to properly walk at that point. But, you know, it was never a choice. Music's never been a great calling for me. It's just sort of something that I've done my whole life.
This I find absolutely fascinating. I want to go back to the pop thing for a little bit, though. That's kind of where I was going. That's where I think when the whole concept, somehow your brain was engaging what was going on, and you responded to it. I think that's really cool.
Sure. That's what it was. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so then my next question was going to be, what drew you to the piano? And I assumed
I was forced. There wasn't a choice.
You were drawn to it.
No. Yes. When in the fetus, I just knew I had a calling to be a musician and piano would be mine. No. Some musicians have stories like that and I'm envious of them because they think they're convinced that they're in the right field. I still wake up every day being like, what am I doing with my life? Yeah. Don't look at me like that. No, it's true. I mean, we all want to.
No, I love this honesty because, you know, people would certainly see a woman who goes all over the world playing music at some of the most prestigious places on the planet, and to hear you say, yeah, it's I don't even know what I'm doing with my life. I love that honesty because I think that's, you know, so many people. It just brings in the humanity of someone who does something that most people on the planet can't do.
Well, I mean, think about it. Like, my job is to be on stage under a spotlight on literally a pedestal while you all look at me in awe, wondering at what profound statements can I make on stage in silence and then clap for me at the end. That's really messed up. And I don't want that. That's not the point for me. And like the fact that I have to do that in order to get across what I'm doing is just, when I think about it objectively, terrifies me.
Thank you. Tanya, beyond the beginnings, the forced beginnings on the piano as a child. You certainly excelled in the academic world. You graduated early from high school, valedictorian, went to Harvard. Biomedical engineering. I'm always in awe of musicians who can have a left side of their brain that functions on that kind of level.
I didn't actually go to Harvard. I don't have a degree in anything like that. I've never felt the calling to be a musician. I think my brain is a lot more analytical than it is creative. The humanities for me in high school were not something that interested me. Still today, they're not my first choice. I'm much more interested about objectivity and things that can be proven and things that, you know, my first dream was to become a doctor because that you're fit. Like, there's no easier way to help people than to help them out of medical situations. But I'm terrified of blood. So I can't do that. So my thought would then be like biomedical engineering. You can, you know, help people medically without actually having to see all that gore aspect to it. Education in this country is stupidly expensive, and there is a lot of scholarship for classical music, even though there's no job prospects after. You don't think about that when you're at that point. So that's sort of why I went into music, also to run away from home in a very, you know, proper way. Going to London is a very polite way of saying, I'm out of here. Yeah, that's sort of how I got into music and probably why I still have those fraudulent feelings of, like, I'm not supposed to be here all the time. And for me, the interesting thing is that, like, you know, I want to live a life of service. I want to, you know, help people in a substantial way. And can music actually do that? And also, who is this awful term of classical music, who is that actually serving? Because, you know, our audience are mostly lovely and wonderfully, you know, wonderful people, but blue-haired old ladies. And is that what we're trying to do? You know, and why is that our audience? For a number of reasons, I can say, but also just the access to music education in this country is so limited, and arts funding in this country is, you know, below any other, you know, country that we look at as competitors. And that's not okay. And that also gets across this whole elitism of classical music, which it really shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes to education. That comes from sort of the atmosphere around a concert. You know, the behavior of a concert is something that is terrifying to a lot of younger people. Like, you have to be silent. You know, you have to stare at a person. The length of attention span that you need is not something that you have in day-to-day, you know, life. And it comes from an era that was, you know, when Bach was living, we didn't have YouTube. So sitting for 15 minutes was not a big deal versus now it is, you know. So how does it also adapt? I think also the interesting thing is that classical musicians aren't really creating a new work. We're not artists per se. Like, you know, if you have a pop singer, a singer-songwriter, or a sculptor, like, you're putting out your own impression of thoughts about life or what, you know, by creating something new. And we're cover bands. You know, we think we're better than everybody because we've done it for so long and we're so skilled at it. And we talk about these profundities and, you know, little details, but we're cover bands. You know, I don't compose. The question I get asked a lot, oh, do you write your own stuff? I'm like, no. Like, it's kind of like asking an actor, do you write your own scripts? No, but, you know, I reinterpret stuff from the past, and how is that relevant today, and how am I bringing my own artistic spin on that to make it, you know, relevant for me and relevant for my audience?
Yeah.
And that's a question that really puzzles me and makes me passionate about changing the way things are.
Thank you. Tanya Gabrielian joining us here on Musicians Spotlight, or Gabrielian. Could also be a...
Call me anything. It's fine. Just call me Tanya.
We'll call her Tanya. Tanya, I'm going to go back to London.
Okay.
Because there's this story, if I may indulge
sure.
the story,
sure.
That's quite remarkable about how I'm going to let you tell the story. Let's just pick it up. You go to London. This is a great story.
Okay, once upon a time. I mean, the story is a little exaggerated to make it sound a little profound than it was. And I don't know, I'll just start with the story. So I hated studying music. I found it's very limiting. I just remember one conversation I was having at the canteen with some other students. And like in London, you have a lot of schools that start from like the age of 8 just doing specialist music schools. And I, of course, like I wanted to take math classes and stuff. And they were like, why would you want to do that? We don't have a precedent for that. Like, you can't do that. I took a couple classes at King's College in, you know, fields that weren't music, which kept me slightly sane. But just the lack of overlap was shocking to me. And I somehow Darwin came up. And this girl that had gone to one of the music schools was like, who is Darwin? And I just wanted to slap her. Like, come on, guys. Like, do you have no knowledge apart from this very narrow thing? And you know, music should be a reflection of your life and your whole experience. And if you literally know nothing about the world, why should I care about what you have to say? So I didn't like music school at all. And, you know, in England, it was all the international people and then the English people. There was no sort of intermixing between the people there. And so I started doing kung fu. I always wanted to do kung fu as a kid. And my parents didn't let me because they thought I would use it on them. And so, like,
it's a very specific a type of kung fu, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, it was called Zhuan Shu Quan.
Forgive my ignorance.
I found this place through somebody that lived in my hall in London, and I went and I loved it. And, like, I was super hardcore about it, and I wanted to fight. And, you know, physical exertion is not something that you get by sitting on a piano bench and, like, moving your fingers. So I loved it. I did it very seriously. And then I was sparring with this guy at one point who was really weird. And I just remember the whole time being like, something's off about him. And I kicked his head, and then my leg slipped. And we were on a hard floor with no mats. Super, super smart. Yeah, good job. And I fell face forward, and I put my hands back to protect my hands because, you know, I play piano. And I was thinking, oh, I have to play in like 2 weeks. I have to make sure I'm okay.
That's a synapse that's firing
yeah,
through your
oh,
head
yeah.
at that
time? Oh, okay. Yeah. This is everything happens. Whenever you have an injury, like it all goes in slow motion.
Uh-huh.
And so I put my hands back to protect them, and I fell on my head instead. So I completely broke up my face, and then I started shaking pretty much uncontrollably. And so this was right before my 19th birthday. I went to the hospital emergency room, and they didn't classify me as a head injury, but rather as broken bones, so they just sent me home. And then a couple days later, I just started shaking. And so on my 19th birthday, I was admitted into hospital for the shaking. I was put in the wrong ward. I mean, basically, I went to 9 hospitals in a month.
Jeez.
2 surgeries for that to put everything back, and damaged nerves in my spine. So that's the what happened physically to me. And during that time was sort of the first time that I listened to me. I mean, like, if you're in a hospital ward, so in England, like, you're on a ward of like 20, 25 people. You're all in the same room. I was pretty much the healthiest person there because it was a non-surgical ward. And I felt kind of like I was an affront to what's going on there because, you know, I was in good health apart from, you know, a couple things. And I was, you know, the first one to get out of there. But I started listening to music. And I mean, there's one time I specifically remember my blood getting drawn. And, you know, I'm very squeamish. I don't like needles. And so I was like crying because I'm a little chicken and I don't want to see my blood. And I was listening to Death and Transfiguration by Strauss while they're taking my blood.
Oh, mercy.
And like acting like somebody had just told me I had 2 weeks to live on this, you know, a ward where people have a lot more serious injuries than me. And like, what is wrong with me? But again, this was the time that I just listened to music to pass the time. And I was like, hey, maybe music can actually help people in a certain way to you know, relieve them of where they are in life at the time. And so after that, I started just reading a bunch of books of trying to figure out, you know, like the meaning of music and how that can affect me. Because, you know, when you go sort of down this classical music path, there is a very set prescription that is not really relevant today. But, you know, you go to conservatory, you go to competitions, you win a prize, and then you get manager, and then you have a career. It doesn't work. Everyone's hanging on to it as though it still works. It doesn't work. But, you know, apart from that, you also don't, I don't think what's focused on is sort of the meaning behind it and how to make it meaningful for you. That's just assumed. Mm-hmm. It's there. And because, you know, I've never felt music as a calling and it's never affected me in that way, I wanted to see how it could do that for other people. And so that's sort of been my life's work after that moment of sort of how to make music relevant, how to make it as, you know, something that brings people together rather than divides them into these mm-hmm. socioeconomic classes and all that kind of stuff. Because when you look at music history and, you know, where it started from, you know, in the Baroque era and before that, you know, it's part of the church or for nobility. And that's not really serving the common man. And then going from there, Industrial Revolution, everybody coming into cities and that social hierarchy changing, you know, it then became a way to sort of show class, made it affordable. But also, you know, if we look today, it's thought of as a super elitist thing. And it shouldn't be.
No,
it should be. It should show us that, you know, dude, since Baroque time, we've all felt the same things. You know, dead white guys felt the same things that anybody else does. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't want to say that these people had the solution to it, but it is relevant today still. And we need to, as artists, focus on how to make that relevance more known.
We'll be back with more music and interview with Tanya Gabrielian here on Musicians Spotlight. Welcome back to Musicians Spotlight and our visit with pianist Tanya Gabrielian. This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm speaking today with Tanya Gabralian. I wanted to get into, Tanya, a couple different things. What brings you to a piece, or what does a piece need to have to bring you to it, to inhabit it or cover it, as you called it? And to me, like, that's when I think of a good cover band. The one that I want to go see, I don't want to go see the tribute bands. I'm not into I'm just going to play it exactly like whatever, the Beatles played it. Or that. I mean, I understand why people are drawn to that.
Right.
I love hearing bands who will cover, or musicians who will cover a popular song or of any genre, and then reinterpret it and kind of make it their own.
Sure.
So what do you look for when you're looking for a repertoire?
The paycheck. No,
you just do not want to have any kind of connotation of being inspired at any way.
Well, think about it though. You can't expect to be inspired when you're told what piece to play and when you play it.
Yeah.
You think that like every time we perform that there's some magical fairies coming down and blessing us with this insight that we're gonna give to the audience? No, it's not like that. You know, you play a lot of pieces that you're told to play. Not because you want to play it. You're told who you're playing with. You're told who the conductor is going to be. You're told who your fellow musicians are going to be. You don't have a choice about that. And so this whole magical experience that general public thinks that we're having on stage is not true at all. It's a job. It's not a hobby. It's not because we love it. It's because that's what we do to feed ourselves, and we have a love for it that's transformed into a way to become a profession. So whenever you play a concerto, you don't get a choice of, I mean, maybe if you're Yo-Yo Ma, you get to pick what concerto you have, but I'm not there, you know, so I'm told what I play and when. Yeah, you do it because you have to, you know, so yeah, the inspiration sort of, you know, you find inspiration in it, but it's also a job, and nobody loves their job 24/7.
Tanya, when you go to your website, one of the things that I appreciate is one of the tabs is for your activism.
Yes.
And the two projects that I think were, seven, eight. I mean,
there's more in the works. I mean, those are just things that I wrote about that I thought I could, you know, have a nice little blurb.
Well, the mental health awareness component of
that's been very important to me.
Can you expound on that a little
bit? Sure. Well, there's this sort of cliche that art comes from, you know, tragic situations and, you know, artists suffer and that creates the great music. And first of all, it's a little bit insulting to think that art can only come from suffering, even though, I mean, a lot of artists have suffered from mental illness in very, you know, tragic circumstances. But, I mean, the whole point of art to me is that everybody can create beauty in this world regardless of their personal circumstances. And And actually, here in Montana, I was getting started on this project, and I was trying to play something for the Bozeman Symphony. They have a piano series, and I asked the conductor, "Hey, can I do a concert based around composers with mental illnesses?" And he was like, "No, our audiences are quite snobby, and they don't want to hear that." And so this sort of this veneer that we put in the concert situation of like high class nonsense and that, like, you know, like this very elite world, and that sort of environment just doesn't interest me at all. And I want to have the audience being pushed. It's like you get also this comment a lot of people, why do you like classical music? Oh, it's so relaxing. You know, the audience should be active participants. It's that hierarchy of the stage and the audience below. Like, I want to level that playing field. And I want the audience to be as much participating in the experience as the performer itself. So not to say that this solves the problem, but I just think an interesting way to bring across sort of mental health issues is by looking at this the composers as human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about Bach, you see a picture of a dude in a powdered wig, like, you know, probably all this fancy dress, you know, supported by royalty and all that kind of stuff. And you don't think of him as a human being. Mm. You know, we think of, you know, I mean, there's the film Amadeus, which really shows the human side of Mozart. But when you play his music, you know, you think of him as this like demigod. Yeah. You don't think about the difficulties he had in life. And you know, once we connect more based on difficult situations than this, you know, this surface level way that we look at this as like, oh, it's all perfect. And we can never achieve that perfection, mm-hmm. you know. So let's talk about these composers' histories, you know, tragic circumstances for so many of them.
And we mentioned Schumann earlier.
Schumann tried to commit suicide 3 times in his life.
I say.
Final 2 years were spent in a mental asylum. Is that what you think of? I mean, he even named his personalities and he wrote music around that. And when he died, Schumann's wife, Clara, and Brahms destroyed some of the music because they said it was tainted by his madness. You know, who are we to judge that? And also, why is that a bad thing? You know, it's still beautiful in a way. I mean, a lot of composers went through Rachmaninoff dedicated his second concerto to his therapist. He had a complete emotional breakdown after the failure of his first symphony, and didn't write for a long time and went to, you know, I mean, this is stuff that's not talked about. You know, you can come out and say you have cancer and get the utmost sympathy. You come out and say you have a mental illness. Nobody wants anything to do with you. And there's all the money in the world for cancer treatment,
right.
No money in mental health. My sister's a psychiatrist, and she was the first one to talk about this and got me thinking in a different way. And, you know, just the support for mental health, just to even, you know, I find it really refreshing when people come to me and talk to me about their problems and I refer them to the counseling services and their universities or whatever. It's like, it's okay to talk about needing help. Is, you know, it's a disease. It's
right.
not a personal characteristic trait that makes you weaker, which is how it's thought of. And then I also started a series at a mental hospital in New York where I was living. It was a mandatory 30-day ward. So, I mean, I can think of probably no place in life where you'd feel lower than a mental hospital. And if you were, you know, committed to be staying there. And I was like, if music is actually something that helps people, let's see if it does help these people. It's not going to change your life. It's not going to get you out of poverty. It's not going to get you out of, you know, any illness you have, but it can make you feel better slightly for a moment. Plus, when you play a work by a composer that had bipolar, for example, you know, people can see a reflection of themselves as like, hey, I have bipolar too. And people would raise their hands and say, like, I have the same diagnosis. This is the guy that you're talking about. And this was for a hospital in Washington Heights for people that, you know, probably did not grow up with classical music. It was primarily Dominican population. We had a translator there so that, you know, to translate into Spanish and talk about the music rather than just performing it. And we did that for a couple years just to see, you know, can music change anything? Not really, but can it entertain people and make them feel better for a moment? Probably so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the healing power of music, does that exist? And how do we take advantage of that? And then how do we also bring that to a population? So I paired up a lot with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is a large grassroots organization for mental health access to care and support for families, Active Minds, which is, you know, on most college campuses and pairing up with that. And also, it brings people that wouldn't normally go to a concert to the concert and to see a different aspect of that. And use music in a relevant way to get, you know, something across rather than just look at me on stage, how great I am.
Tanya, Seven last words?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's a little harder to pull off. But, you know, there's a piece by Haydn called The Seven Last Words of Christ on the Cross. And it was written for Lent. Now, I am not, you know, super familiar with the Bible, but I do realize that when Christ was crucified, there were seven statements that he mentioned while he was being crucified. And Haydn wrote this piece to be have these statements recited between each movement. And I thought, you know, it would be an interesting parallel to, you know, the whole idea of Christ dying for humanity's sins, and to look at, you know, really sinners, people that have been convicted of murder and been put to death. And the word used most in these final statements, you can look online. Texas has published all the final statements from prisoners executed since, I believe, the 80s. And when you start reading it, first of all, you see statistics that are overwhelming on the level of education that they've gone through, you know. I mean, you can see, and this is not something that's necessarily meant to be my opinion about the death penalty, but the word used the most is love.
In the statements.
In the statements themselves.
Their final statements of these folks who are executed.
I mean, we are all mortal beings. We do not know when we're going to die. These are people that are in the very unusual position of knowing when they're going to die.
I thought about that, yeah.
And what do they want to be known for? What's most important to them at that moment? And also that dichotomy of the sinner having so much love in their heart, I think, is something very relevant to look at of how we should live our own lives. You know, we can learn a lot from these people. And just put that juxtaposition also of Christ versus death penalty prisoners. Mm-hmm. So going through those statements and then putting those statements in between the piece by Haydn in itself, we're also bringing it a little more relevance today. I worked with a dance company to choreograph to them, and, you know, there's a whole number of ways it can be done. But again, it's also a very depressing thing. It's not meant to be depressing. It's meant to actually be uplifting.
Well, yeah,
but
I mean,
when you present it to be like to someone and be like, hey, I want to talk about the death penalty in Haydn, like, it's not the greatest sell. And, you know, we have to be commercial about this too, and not a lot of people want to put that on.
Yeah.
Just like the snobs in Montana didn't want me to talk about mental health on stage.
Yeah,
so,
well, to me, it makes perfect sense to juxtapose those
I
things.
Think it's super interesting.
Frankly, it's the most Christian thing. Not that you're maybe trying to do that as a Christian person, but that's something that you want to look at exactly.
That is something, and you know, it's also it's expecting a lot from an audience, that you have to go there with an open mind and to think rather than just have the experience that we now have for a class concert of like, oh, it's relaxing and I want to, you know, be seen at this, or, you know, it's asking a lot from an audience.
Yeah.
But we should.
This is John Floridus. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm speaking today with Tanya Gabralian. Tanya, we started the interview off talking about the accident you had in London and in the Kung Fu class. I couldn't help wondering, did you find your way back to Kung Fu?
Well, I tried, but I was,
yeah,
I had the fear.
Like a natural question.
I had the fear. You can't fight if you have the fear.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I tried to go back. I didn't want to be scared of it, but I, knowing what happened to me, I can't relax in that situation again. So yeah, it was an unsuccessful return.
Oh, sorry. Were there, if I may ask, were there other things that you have been able to do to kind of come to terms with that aspect, that fear aspect, that challenge yourself
of
in other
falling?
Ways? Well,
no.
Well, physically, I'm curious.
No.
Are there athletic things?
It's
or
okay.
Sports
I will never be a part of UFC, and I've come to terms with that.
But if you could.
Think
of the sellouts you would have at your concerts. And talking about paychecks.
Oh.
UFC.
Maybe that's what I've been missing.
Concert pianist.
That's the way to success. Yeah. Concert pianist / UFC fighter.
I'm telling you.
Okay.
That's
money. Be my manager?
Yes, I'm in.
You're on.
But what are the kinds of things you're doing for fun outside of...
For fun?
Yeah.
Oh,
do
my
you
God.
Have to do
I've
fun?
Been, like, I've been thinking about this so much. I don't have hobbies. I don't have time for them. I would love to. I don't even know how to ride a bike. I never learned as a kid. I would like to... Can somebody please teach me how to
say,
ride
about,
a bike?
I was about to put an APB out on,
yeah.
on over the air
I
for
I mean, just the
listeners.
Basic things that like you give up... as a child to do this career. Like, I mean, this is what I've done recently to make myself feel better when I'm, you know, on the road and stuff is just, I watch gymnastics and ice skating because those are the people that have given up as much as I have. But the thing
That's
with those
really
people is that their career ends in their 20s.
Right.
And they stop because it's not a sustainable
yeah.
sort of, you know, devotion to something.
Right.
But we don't. We keep on going.
Yeah.
So, I think in a way it's healthier than what we do, what they've done.
Hmm.
But it's the same level of commitment needed from childhood as gymnastics and ice skating and
That's a really
you know
interesting
any other
point.
Of these very highly disciplined sports.
Yeah,
just without any of the glitter and glory that they get.
Right. Well, they're you know they're basing it on their whole careers are based on their bodies. There's a limit to how long your body can you know produce in peak performance.
Mm.
And some people could say the same thing maybe for fine motor skills with classical or with any kind of musicians. And yet the interpretation, the life that comes to musicians. I remember something that comes to my mind is the famous classical guitarist Andre Segovia said. The famous Bach Chaconne, which you have, I don't know if you did the transcription.
No, but, that was okay. Salahi.
But recorded it. Some people say the most amazing composition ever. He said musicians should not even try that until they get to be 50 years old.
Sure. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not 50 yet.
You
should I be lucky
well.
Enough to get there? I'll come back to it.
Yeah. But that's an interesting parallel.
Yeah. Huh?
Well, great. TanyaGabralian.com is the name of Tanya's website. I'm going to spell it again for listeners. T-A-N-Y-A, that's the Tanya part. And Gabralian is G-A-B-R-I-E-L-I-A-N. Tanya Gabralian or Tanya Gabralian. Gabby.
Tanya. Just Tanya, please.
It's been a pleasure talking shop with you here on Musician Spotlight. Thank you so much for making time
Thanks
to come by
and
hanging out. This is John Floridis. You've been listening to Musicians Spotlight. Our guest has been Tanya Gabralian. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our program is available as a podcast from those websites as well as through iTunes. This interview was engineered by Michael Marsalek. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.